Everybody, welcome back for another episode with your internet historians. I'm Nicole.
I'm Lisa.
And I'm Alec.
How's everyone doing today? Look at Lisa with her makeup on today.
Hey.
Oh,
you're
right.
Someone got ready for us.
What's up?
I was like, why are you wearing makeup?
Yeah.
Well, because I started this new Instagram. And okay, so it's about beer. And at first I was taking pictures of beer. And then I found a bunch of girls who also do beer reviews. And they freaking get all dressed up in these pictures. And I'm like, oh, is that the key?
Oh, yeah. Hello.
I forget. Well, the guy I follow, it's a guy. I forget, like, oh. Girls and guys are different. Like, guys.
Girls, like, have to, like, try.
Yeah. Girls have to look cute. And guys
what
have
is
to
the Instagram?
Loggergram.
Loggergram. Is it logger.gram?
Yeah, I just call it logger.
I just spell log. Like, am I spelling it wrong? Why is it not? Okay, there it is. I was like, why is it not telling you?
And anyways.
Okay, that first pick.
Yeah, it's like freaking annoying because I'm like, is this? Okay, guys, I did not realize how big reels are because that reel I posted last night, I didn't even think about it. I was mostly doing it because I took pictures of food or videos of food when I was with my cousins and I didn't want to put it on my actual Instagram. So I put it on that Instagram just for like funsies and just so I could show it to my cousins. And like it said that it showed to like 4,000 people.
Damn. I mean, I look at reels. More than
Reels.
I don't have TikTok, so I just look at reels.
I don't have TikTok either, but I just didn't realize it would get that far. It literally tripped me out because, like, all for like an hour, it was like, and I was like, what?
Wow.
No one looks at this freaking Instagram. What the heck? And it kind of is like a little letdown today because I posted that picture and it's like 6 likes, and I'm like, okay, last time I got like 60 from this reel that I did not care about.
Here, I'll like it too. There you go. I don't like your reel. I know it's so freaking annoying how much Instagram is really pushing reels. Mm-hmm. Like their algorithm very much favors reels. And it's just like, you know what? I don't need more work as a business owner and like being on social media. That's posting pictures is difficult enough. It's like, I'm not going to go spend an hour videotaping stuff and putting, it's like,
yeah,
more crap to do.
No, definitely.
It's like, I know
social media is so stressful.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's like, why?
So like today I was like, okay, let me like record something and let's see, I'll put it on reel and actually it'll be actually what the whole Instagram is supposed to be about. Mm-hmm. Not this stupid little reel that I was like, oh, let me just do this real quick.
So I can send it to my cousin. One of our reels, I guess I had one in drafts and I didn't post it, or I did.
I don't know. A reel.
I'll make clips of this that we're doing and then I'll post it on reels, but one of them got 1,000 views.
Oh wow, look at us.
I just haven't been keeping up with making the reels.
No,
but I made like 4 or 5 or something like that.
I will say put a couple of hashtags on it because I was like, you know, I really was like, I doubt this is even gonna go anywhere, but here, let me put like a couple of hashtags just why not. And yeah, last night I was like tripping out. I was like, oh, this works.
But anyway, shall we get into what we're going to be talking about today?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So in today's episode, we will be discussing the history behind the movie Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile. Single mother Liz falls in love with Ted Bundy and for years refuses to believe he is guilty of the kidnappings and heinous crimes against women he is accused of. So what do you guys think of the movie?
I did not like it.
Okay.
Jeez, Lisa, do you like any movies at all?
Yeah, have I been hating every movie we've been watching?
Yes.
Oh, okay. What's next on the list? Let's see if there's one that'll come
Iron
up
Jawed
that I might
Angels.
Like. Okay, but I mean, I
liked it. Was it? I liked that. Like, I mean, towards the, once I realized that they like kind of reenacted as much as they did, I feel like I liked it even more because, like, you know, at the end, how they showed all the stuff that they basically reenacted. I was like, oh my God, that's cool. But I liked it. But I think it was like different than what I think, you know, going into a movie like that, you think you're going to see like him committing crimes and stuff, but you didn't see any of that. So I think if you're kind of, you know, going into it for that, you're not going to get that out of it. But I think overall it was pretty good. I think it was, how long was the movie? Because I feel like that's the only thing. It was like kind of like
hour 50.
That's
55.
It.
Yeah.
I mean, that is long.
I mean,
some,
it's like standard.
Some movies we've watched have been like 3 hours.
Yeah. I was like, it's pretty standard, but I don't know. I guess some parts of it seemed a little bit to drag a little bit, but I mean, I think overall I enjoyed it. And this is my second time watching it. And the first time, I don't think I paid attention really at all. So this time when I was actually paying attention, I was like, oh, it's not as bad as I thought it was the first time, you know, but.
Yeah, this is my second time watching it too. I like it. I mean, have you guys watched the Ted Bundy tapes that Netflix did, which is more like serious true crime, actually, you know, real Ted Bundy. But I feel like both this and the tapes, I feel like they came out pretty close together.
Yeah, weren't they by the same guy?
I don't think so.
Oh, I thought they were.
I don't remember, but I know the Ted Bundy tapes, it was like a series, like going through it chronologically. So it was kind of interesting because I think I watched the Zac Efron movie first and then the tapes came out and I watched that. But it is kind of a different and interesting take. Like, I kind of like that it was more about Liz. I mean, it was about Ted, obviously, but it's like, it's kind of, I feel like it kind of took a view of, oh, we all know about Ted Bundy type of a thing. You're not watching this movie to learn about Ted Bundy, which is like, okay, because it's kind of like with Spider-Man or like Batman, where it's just like you've heard their origin story a million times. Like, let's see it from a different point of view. So yeah, I kind of like that,
like a different perspective to
because you see her struggle, I guess, and like how much it took a toll on her. So it is a very interesting point of view.
Yeah, and then I saw something, or I read something about, like, you know how I already said they didn't show like him committing any crimes, and that was because Liz thought he was innocent this whole time. So then at the end, when we kind of see him commit a crime, is when, like, that's when she kind of was like waking up to the fact that he was guilty of those things. So I thought that was cool too when I read about it. I was like, oh, yeah, I didn't pick up on that was the reason why, but, like, you know, it makes sense.
I'm like over here like, nope, didn't like it.
Wait, why didn't you like it? What are you,
because I'm like reasoning? Madly in love with Zac Efron. I went back and I saw that, I forgot that I slid into his DMs. So I went back and I checked on it, and yeah, and there's still no response, but that's okay. You know, there's still time for us. no, I mean, I don't know. I didn't feel like Ted was like twisted enough, I guess. Like, I wanted to see a little bit more of that. Just, I don't know.
It wasn't the point that they were like trying to make him, because he was very charming.
I remember exactly. I heard that the reason why they also casted Zach is because at the time, like during that time, a lot of women found him attractive and charming. So Zach's like the perfect, because that's like what we think is, what I think is attractive and charming.
When it came out, there was a lot of criticism of why the heck would you, you know, cast someone so attractive as this serial killer? And it's just like, so you understand like what what these women felt towards him, because they kind of show it in the movie, these women that would come to trial. You know, there's Carol Ann, who was freaking infatuated with, because he was freaking charming. He wanted you to fall in love with him. Like, that's what these freaking sociopaths do. I mean, they're smart, and like, that's, they know how to win people over and talk their way out of anything. So it made a lot of sense to me. I mean,
I actually think I thought he actually did a good job at portraying Ted Bundy in this film as well.
It was a very, like, I feel like, I mean, I'm trying to think of like other serious roles that he's really done that haven't been like romantic, whatever, freaking High School Musical.
but I feel like that movie, like Milkman or something like that, Paperboy.
Oh, yeah, but isn't that, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's not like a romantic, you know,
I didn't watch it. I don't know. I just know it was like a little bit out of his element.
Yeah,
I get it. I know it's like, it's a good role for him. I didn't think he did a bad job. I think it was just hard for me. I don't know. I had different expectations going in. So
there were some angles of him and like some shots of him that actually really looked like him, like Ted Bundy.
Yeah, I was like, they do kind of look a little similar. Like, I don't know. I could see kind of it.
The resemblance.
Kind of, yeah. Because I mean, they both kind of have like a pointy nose.
The hair was pretty on.
Yeah, I was like, the hair was like good too.
And so like, I was texting you guys about the unibrow, I was upset. Unibrow later, and because I thought that would make him unattractive to us these days. So,
yeah, exactly. Okay, so this information I got from biography.com. So how did Liz and Ted meet? They met in 1969. So in her book,
oh, I was going to say too, in the last thing or the last episode, when I was like saying what we're going to be talking about, I said her last name was Kendall, but I guess that was just like a pseudonym or whatever the hell she went under for the book. But her real last name is Kofler? Something. I don't know how to say it, but yeah.
So, I'm not going to say it either.
Yeah, I was like, but Kendall's not her last name. I mean, right. For the book it is, I guess, but yeah.
Yeah. So in her book, Liz says that she's trying to escape a creepy guy at the bar when she saw Ted sitting alone and she approached him. Thinking he looked sad, she said to him, "You look like your best friend just died." The two began to talk, conversation flowed naturally, and the chemistry was instant. Ted ended up spending the night, it was a platonic night, at their house, and they became a couple a short time later. Damn. I didn't know that people
weird
had
pickup line.
Platonic. Yeah, okay, yeah, that is weird.
You look like your friend just, and then what would have happened if his friend did just die? Like, how do you respond to that?
I know, that's true.
Like a, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, they met at the bar, just like how they showed in the movie. So let's see, did she report him? Yes. Things started to get strange in 1974 after news reports surfaced of murders and rapes of two women in the area. The name Ted was being mentioned by witnesses, as well as the Volkswagen, like the one Bundy drove. Can I read? Liz was suspicious but reluctant to believe that Ted was capable of murder. When she questioned him about the strange behaviors, like when she found a meat cleaver at his desk and a surgical glove in his coat pocket, or drove hundreds of miles to Colorado in one night to do some de-stress from work, he used his intelligence and charm to talk his way out of it. Eventually, she made the difficult decision to betray the man she loved to go to the police. They didn't think Bundy was a killer, and she stayed with him and never told anyone that she had gone to the authorities. Oh, she never told him. Not. She probably told somebody later. Well, obviously, because we know now. But did she believe he was innocent, and why couldn't she let him go? So she kind of, it was like the innocence thing was like a yes, no. I think that she always, to me, from what I can, like when I'm reading all of this, it sounds like she had this gut feeling that she knew he wasn't innocent, but she just chose not to listen to that because she was blinded by her love and dependency on him. Because like, why would you report him if you didn't have this like feeling, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If you really believed he was innocent, you wouldn't have gone to the police, but she went to the police because she was like, something is shady. Mm-hmm. I think she also didn't want to believe it because this is a guy she was like in love with. So she described herself as a shy, insecure, and lonely single mom who was struggling with alcoholism. She said, "I handed Ted my life and said, here, take care of me. He did in a lot of ways, and I became more and more dependent upon him. When I felt his love, I was on top of the world. When I felt nothing from Ted, I felt that I was nothing." And she also had this fantasy that she was in, like, of a stable household with a lawyer husband. And she told Vanity Fair, "I still view him as Ted that I thought I knew because I just couldn't wrap my head around what they were saying. And so many years later, after much counseling, praying, and growing, I've accepted who he is, what he was accused of being. He's a violent, rageful sex deviant. I could not wrap my head around it in the beginning." So, yeah, I mean, like, I get that. I think it's like if we found out anybody in our life was like this murderer, like who done these types of crimes, I think anybody would have a hard time wrapping their head around that. Mm-hmm. 'Cause you know, this person as like one part of them, you know, and obviously this murder part of him was like a secret, right? He didn't know, his close friends and family don't know that about him.
Do you have how long they were together before stuff started really picking up with the accusations? 'Cause it seemed like they were together for like a few years.
Yeah. They were together.
The time skip in the movie, at least.
No, they were together for a long time. I want to say, oh my gosh, I want to say like 5 years. I totally can't remember now, but I read it a couple of times, like how long they were actually together. So I want to, around like 5-ish years, I would say. Yeah. But
I mean, that's how it seemed in the movie, but yeah. I wasn't sure.
Yeah. And she obviously was there for him in the first trial and stuff, but she... Yeah,
I just don't get how she was still trying to like be all in love with him when he was with the Boone lady, or like she was still having a heart. Like they weren't together, I guess.
Right,
like,
they weren't like, together at the time.
But I mean, like she was still like, I don't know, believing.
Upset.
Yeah, and like believing his innocence and shit. I'm just like, how?
I think she's just like in denial. Yeah. She was still in denial at that time.
Probably just like hurt worse to, you know, give in to what everybody is saying and, mm-hmm. you know, finally
I agree.
Realize. especially if she was like a struggling alcoholic and stuff, like it just is like a whole spiral.
Yes. Well, okay, so I said that Liz kind of reminded me of the girls from Teen Mom. It's just that like they desperately wanted to get out of that like single mom, I don't know, title.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. they were willing to like, and Liz has said it herself, like about how she kind of was settling with Ted because she just so desperately wanted like this husband. And I think like, yeah, to get rid of that single mom, I don't know, title, whatever, because she just didn't want that anymore. And then as you said too, it's just hard to believe that you trusted this guy with your child into your home and he's mm-hmm. doing these things. And she said it too. It made her, for a long time, she questioned her judgment of people. So that, oh, yeah, that sucks.
I think she should. Yeah, I mean, if she was with Ted Bundy for that long.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know. I feel like it's just like a different chapter of everybody's lives. Like, I don't know.
Yeah,
I
mean, that's true.
Because there's always a time where, you know, before the crimes were committed, where the person was completely normal and then they slipped into their ways, you know, so.
But I mean, it seems like, I don't know, some of I read that he was kind of the way he was for like a long time, like probably when he was like a young teenager or something.
Like when they.
Oh, that's their speculation. The murders, he never confirmed it.
Right, right. Because by the time he was really killing, it seemed like he knew what he was doing. Mm-hmm. He wasn't like an amateur. Did they portray their relationship accurately? I want to say no. I did not feel like it was portrayed. Like, I mean, he did call her. I don't know. Like, I guess to me, I didn't feel that like hot and cold between him, like from him to Liz. When she talked about how when she felt his love, she felt on top of the world. And when she felt nothing from him, she felt like nothing. Like, I guess I just didn't really get that. So
I feel like they did. I feel like the way that this movie progresses is very specific in the way that like it's very much, they try to frame it as like this romantic, you know, love story situation. They met at a bar and blah blah blah. They just slept in the same bed the first night, like nothing happened, and he didn't try to push anything, you know, whatever, he didn't care that she had a kid, blah blah blah. And I feel like especially with the one scene where they do actually get intimate, they very much show it. It's like a mutual, whatever, they're about to get intimate. But then later on, when all this stuff and she's starting to realize, she notices then all like the red flags essentially of like, oh, how he was looking at her and all that, you know? So I feel like it's very deliberate the way that they show, you know, their relationship. Which, yeah, so I thought that was kind of interesting because kind of like reading about what she said, oh yeah, he would do these things type of a thing, like, but the way that they showed in the movie wasn't until later when she was like seeing it, like
oh, looking back and like, oh shit, that was a red flag, that was a red flag, what he was actually
yeah, that's true. I mean, yeah, when you're like in bliss, you'll always ignore that stuff.
Exactly.
So. Yeah, because I think I saw something that same base. Well, I mean, it was her saying it. I don't know. I mean, obviously Ted couldn't say it himself, but she was like, I guess someone, or I don't know if someone asked her something. I don't know. I forget what it was.
Yeah, but basically, the girl was saying, like, why are you so upset, or why do you care? I don't know. Her friend was saying something.
Someone, they were just talking about like was Ted as like into her as like it like shows in the film, like, you know, constantly calling her up and like, why aren't you, you know, whatever, you didn't answer my calls. And she said that, yeah, that he was like super into her or whatever. But I mean, I don't know.
So that's the thing, is that for me, even though I understand what you guys are saying, that like she kind of like love was blind, the only thing that I think we needed was a little bit of understanding how she even got that type of like feeling to go report him. You know, you don't just go report somebody, right? You're close to. You have to like see some strange behavior from him. And at that time, like, we weren't seeing any strange behavior. True. So to me, that's also what
they did. Yeah. They just saw the sketch.
They don't show it in the movie. Yeah. That's true.
Because she was saying, like in the movie, it just showed the sketch on the TV or whatever. And it wasn't her friend the one trying to be like, that looks like, or am I?
Yeah. Her friend did say something about that. But yeah, like I said, like, if I'm freaking watching TV and I see a sketch drawing that looks like Nicole, I'm not going to be like, oh my God, I should go call the police and report that my friend Nicole looks like your sketch, right? I ain't gonna do that, you know. I'm gonna be like, yeah. Probably that's not, I mean, yeah, it looks like a goal, but it's just a freaking sketch, you know. Yeah. So yeah.
I feel like it must have been a time thing with this movie being 2 hours. Like, they must have felt like they didn't have enough time to really, because when I was reading, they're talking about how she did come across weird stuff. I mean, really all she went through his suitcase. And then there was like the time that he woke her up under the covers. He had a flashlight or whatever.
Oh, yeah. They showed like that part, but it wasn't even that creepy.
No, but that's what I'm saying, though. I feel like that's like all they felt like they had time that they could really show, because she does say, oh, yeah, I did come across stuff in his apartment and at my house that was unusual. And I feel like that more helped her like decide whether or not she was going to call in anonymously or whatever. Yeah. But in the movie, they like very slightly put it in. So it does kind of seem out of nowhere that she called in. And maybe that's why they didn't put that confession really until the end of the movie. I don't know, but. Yeah, it does.
Yeah, there definitely had to be some types of, like, she must have been suspicious in some aspect of something, that he was up to something, in order for her to see that sketch and be like, I need to call these people in. But then after, she felt bad about it, like she didn't believe it. So I don't know. She's confusing me. Yeah. I mean, like, obviously, the thing is, I think in like her deep recesses of her mind or her heart, or whatever, she probably knew that he was in fact guilty, but she, like we already said, was blinded by the love that she had for him, and that she was choosing to not, like, you know, listen to that part of her that knew he was guilty, and listen to the part that was like, I'm in love with this man, though he treats me and my daughter good and all that stuff.
Yeah,
because I think, yeah, it really does go back to the part where, like, some women, when they're single mothers, they feel like they're like tainted or whatever, where they're just like, you know, I'll never be able to find somebody, because who wants to deal with, you know, me and my baggage, or me and my child, like. So she probably just felt like she needed to cling on.
Yes.
Totally.
Yeah. The only thing I had to read here, though, is again from Vanity Fair. She said, this is kind of hard to even think about, but if you could put aside the fact that Ted Bundy was a terrible, murderous man, he was also a bad boyfriend. I hope that people, women, realize that they don't need to settle. Some of the things that were just plain flat out codependence on my part, accepting when things were going badly, thinking that it was just something about me and that I needed to change. I hope that women don't do what I did, which is being treated not 100% truthfully. Yeah, so I'm glad she was able to come out of this. Like, I just can't imagine, like, you know, how I'd feel if I was ever in her situation. And then again, the aftermath of everything. So sounds like she's doing a lot better now. Her and her daughter is okay. And she said that she wrote that book. I forgot what it's called, like My Prince or something. Yeah,
Dark Prince or something like that.
Yeah. She said that, like, you know, because that came out, I think, in the 80s. And then she said when she read it again, she was kind of like not too happy with it. And I understand, because obviously, like, if I were to read something I wrote 10 years ago, I'd be like, ooh, cringe. So yeah, you're she a made totally some edits.
Person.
Yeah. So I guess she made some edits, and she said that she's a lot happier with the edits. I did see that is that her and her daughter were like kind of upset with this fascination people have of Ted Bundy.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. So, I would imagine.
Yeah. They don't like the fact that, like, all of a sudden he's resurfacing and people are into true crime. They don't like that. So that's the only thing that I seen. Well, that I was like, ooh, this is juicy information.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he was very into the fact that he was like a little celebrity.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Exactly. Like, we shouldn't glamorize these people.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it is. It's like, it's a very strange and fine line when it comes to being a fan of true crime. Cause it's like, I listen to My Favorite Murder, and like, I'm part of the like murderino groups or whatever on Facebook and stuff. But like, I'm part of this Etsy Murderino group where
what's Murderino?
Like,
that's what, like, they call the fans. You know how, like, yeah, Lady Gaga fans. Has her monsters. And
if like you're a Murderino, you listen to My Favorite Murder and true crime. But yeah, and it's like for, you know, Etsy sellers or whatever, who are also whatever. But like, they're quite often, you know, people kind of have to be put in their place of what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate, because there's definitely been times where people have gotten into like full on arguments trying to list something that is just like so brazenly inappropriate, you know, when it comes to the victim's families seeing that type of stuff, and, you know, just glorifying the killers and stuff. It's just like, some people I feel like some people just don't grasp that these were real people and that those were real things that happened, because it did happen a while ago. And it's just like some people didn't live through it or weren't alive yet, you know? And it's just like, I feel like people forget. They read all this stuff and it's just like, no, these are real people. And these real people, like, they died and their families are still alive and have to, you know, deal with this. And it's just like, it's unfortunate that people fantasize and put these people up.
I was going to say, it's like, I agree about how, like, I think they forget that the villains or whatever, like the murderers are, like, you know, bad people and they shouldn't be like glorified or anything. But I also feel like it's probably because, like, people, you know, people love being part of fandoms. And so I think, like, they, in their minds, they're thinking that they're just showing that they're fandom for like true crime, but it's like, that's not the way you should do it though. Like, like it's different when it's based in real life shit, you know? Next, we're going to be learning about Ted Bundy's capture and his trials, which we're going to get right into after this short ad break.
All right. So, I mean, the way that they portrayed it in the movie, especially if you watch this movie and then watch the Ted Bundy tapes, and it's like, it's pretty spot on reenacting essentially of how it went. So I tried to cut it down, since, you know, if you've watched this movie, then you already know all this stuff. But there are some elements that they did leave out from the movie just for the sake of time, I would assume. On August 16th, 1975, Bundy was arrested by Utah Highway Patrol officer Bob Hayward in Granger, which is a Salt Lake City suburb. Hayward observed Bundy cruising a residential area in the pre-dawn hours and fleeing at high speed after seeing the patrol car. Hayward noticed that the Volkswagen's front passenger seat had been removed and placed on the rear seats, and searched the car. He found a ski mask, a second mask fashioned from pantyhose, a crowbar, handcuffs, trash bags, a coil of rope, an ice pick, and other items initially assumed to be burglary tools. Bundy explained that the ski mask was for skiing. He had found the handcuffs in a dumpster and the rest were common household items. I feel like the way that they put that in the movie, like, he like glances at the bag and then like immediately arrests him. I'm just like, wait, is that how that works?
I feel like that was probably how it was, is that Ted was probably being like, hella, like his eyes were being like this. And then, you know, you're kind of
I also like how both times in the film where he's like, the lights, they startled me or something. And it's just like, he just he like uses that probably all the time. And like other times he's been pulled over or whatever.
And like, it's such a weird and like drastic difference between like the way that stops go now, because like he fully gets out of the car, the cop does not care. And he's like trying to find his wallet for the longest time. And it's just like, oh my God, I would think he's pulling a gun out. Like, what the and the cop's just like, what's going on, dude? Like, it's like, what year is this? It's ridiculous. However, Detective Jerry Thompson remembered a similar suspect and car description from the November 1974 Durant kidnapping and Bundy's name from Clofer's December 1974 phone call. In a search of Bundy's apartment, police found a guide to Colorado ski resorts with a checkmark by the Wildwood Inn and a brochure that advised the Viewmont High School play in Bountiful, where Deborah Kent had disappeared. The police did not have sufficient evidence to detain Bundy, and he was released on his own recognizance. Bundy later said that researchers missed a hidden collection of Polaroid photographs of his victims, which he destroyed after he was released. Salt Lake City police placed Bundy on 24-hour surveillance, and Thompson flew to Seattle with two other detectives to interview Clofer, Liz. she told them that in the year prior to Bundy's move to Utah, she had discovered objects that she couldn't understand in her house and in Bundy's apartment. These items included crutches, a bag of plaster of Paris that he admitted stealing from a medical supply house, a meat cleaver that was never used for cooking. Additional objects included surgical gloves, an oriental knife in a wooden case that he kept in his glove compartment, and a sack full of women's clothing.
Yeah,
there's your red flag.
Wait,
girl.
Okay, wait. If you saw a sack of woman's clothing, I would assume not even just murder, but like, is he cheating on me?
Cheating? Yeah. Yes.
What the hell?
The dependency ran deep.
Yeah. I don't know if you read this, but Ted said that he burned a head in Liz's fireplace.
Yikes! Yeah. Where was she?
I guess she wasn't there at that time, but he was like, I think I read something like he said that, and he was like, yeah, she's going to be really mad when she finds that one out.
Like, oh my God. Insane.
Yeah.
In September, Bundy sold his Volkswagen Beetle to a Midvale teenager. Utah police impounded it and FBI technicians dismantled and searched it. They found hairs matching samples obtained from Karen Campbell's body. Later, they also identified hair strands, quote, microscopically indistinguishable from those of Melissa Smith and Carol DeRanch. FBI lab specialist Robert Neal concluded that the presence of hair strands in one car matching three different victims who had never met one another would be, quote, a coincidence of mind-boggling rarity. So I'm pretty sure, like, just like the way that they are doing the evidence and the hair samples and stuff, I think this was before DNA testing, I want to say, because I feel like that's pretty damning right there if they could test the DNA.
I
was going to say,
I think the DNA, I think, didn't come out until like the 90s. So I'm pretty positive that, yeah, with the hair, they would just do like a microscope like type of identification. Mm-hmm. But I was just going to say, that's like, I don't know if we want to talk about this later about like the type of evidence and how it's like different, how we would do it differently today.
Yeah, we can talk about that later. The lack of like DNA technology definitely makes sense when it came to the bite marks that I will talk about later, because that is pretty specific to his bite. So on October 2nd, detectives put Bundy into a lineup. DeRanch immediately identified him as Officer Roseland. Oh, and witnesses from Bountiful recognized him as the stranger at the high school auditorium. There was insufficient evidence to link him to Deborah Kent, whose body was never found, but there was more than enough evidence to charge him with aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault in the DeRanch case. He was freed on $15,000 bail paid by his parents and spent most of the time between indictment and trial in Seattle, living in Liz's house. Seattle police had insufficient evidence to charge him in the Pacific Northwest murders, but kept him under close surveillance. When Ted and I stepped out on the porch to go somewhere, so many unmarked police cars started up that it sounded like the beginning of the Indy 500, says Liz. In November, the three principal Bundy investigators, Jerry Thompson from Utah, Robert Keppel from Washington, and Michael Fisher from Colorado, met in Aspen, Colorado, and exchanged information with 30 detectives and prosecutors from five states. While officials left the meeting, later known as the Aspen Summit, convinced that Bundy was the murderer they sought, they agreed that more hard evidence would be needed before he could be charged with any of the murders. In February 1976, Bundy stood trial for the DeRanch kidnapping. On the advice of his attorney, John O'Connell, Bundy waived his right to a jury due to the negative publicity surrounding the case. After a four-day bench trial and a weekend of deliberation, Judge Stuart Hansen Jr. found him guilty of kidnapping and assault. In June, he was sentenced to 115 years in the Utah State Prison. In October, he was found hiding in bushes in the prison yard carrying an escape kit, roadmaps, airline schedules, and a Social Security card, and spent several weeks in solitary confinement because of that. Man, I feel like they can just really get anything in prison. Some of the stuff that they get is like, what the heck? Later that month, Colorado authorities charged him with Karen Campbell's murder. After a period of resistance, he waived extradition proceedings and was transferred to Aspen in January 1977. All right, so on to his escapes, which were relatively successful, actually.
Yeah, that's what I was mind blown by those. Well, yeah, anyways.
Yeah. So on June 7th, 1977, Bundy was transported 40 miles from the Garfield County Jail in Glenwood Springs to Pitkin County Courthouse in Aspen for a preliminary hearing. He had elected to serve as his own attorney and as such was excused by the judge from wearing handcuffs or leg shackles. Why give him the chance? What are you doing? During a recess, he asked to visit the courthouse's law library to research his case. While shielded from his guard's view behind a bookcase, never should be out of your view. What are you doing? Behind a bookcase.
Especially if there's a window or.
It's just like, I don't know. It's just like if someone is like about to stand trial and has already been like, you know, in jail for these other things, but now he's like, he's stepping his game up to murder. It's just like, really? You keep your eyes on this person at all times. Like, what the heck?
Yeah. I was saying, my only thing is, like, with Ted Bundy and his escapes, I guess I just never understood, like, what was his plan for after he escaped? Like, it just seemed like he was just, like, I don't
winging
know.
Winging it?
Yeah, and, like.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
But anyway.
I guess it's hard to have a plan, right?
Well, it just like, didn't. It just seemed like he was trying to, like, carry on. At least, like, in the film, it made it seem like he was just doing things that he would normally be doing if he wasn't. Like, you know, in jail, like, he was driving his car. He was.
I know that was so it's very just like, weird. I was just, like, why were you driving a bug again?
Yeah.
Like, what are you
that's
doing?
What I'm saying. And it just seemed like he was just carrying on like business as usual. Like, and like, yeah. Maybe he's going to try and find another victim or something, but it's just, I don't know. Just didn't seem like what's the point of that?
No, I can't remember if I wrote it down. I might say it again later, but I mean, he did believe that once he got to Florida, like, he was just going to lay low and just like live his life. Cause he really felt like he could evade authorities in Florida. That's like, boy, they coming for you hard in Florida.
That's just that his ego was obviously just very,
oh yeah.
But
yeah.
The crimes in Florida were just so much worse that it also seemed like he just was, it's kind of like a person who just escaped rehab. Like when they go get, you know, their hands on their drug, they kind of go hard, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Yeah. When you fall off the wagon, you fall hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So while shielded from his guards' view behind a bookcase, he opened a window and jumped to the ground from the second story, injuring his right ankle as he landed. After shedding an outer layer of clothing, he walked through Aspen as roadblocks were being set up on its outskirts, then hiked southward onto Aspen Mountain. Near its summit, he broke into a hunting cabin and stole food, clothing, and a rifle. The following day, he left the cabin and continued south towards the town of Crested Butte, but became lost in the forest. For 2 days, he wandered aimlessly on the mountain, missing two trails that led downward to his intended destination. On June 10th, he broke into a camping trailer on Maroon Lake, 2 miles south of Aspen, taking food and a ski parka. But instead of continuing southward, he walked back north towards Aspen, eluding roadblocks and search parties along the way. 3 days later, he stole a car at the edge of Aspen Golf Course. Cold, sleep-deprived, and in constant pain from his sprained ankle, he drove back into Aspen, where 2 police officers noticed his car weaving in and out of its lane and pulled him over. He had been a fugitive for 6 days. In the car were maps of the mountain area around Aspen that prosecutors were using to demonstrate the location of Karen Campbell's body, indicating that his escape was not a spontaneous act, but had been planned. So back in jail in Glenwood Springs, Bundy ignored the advice of friends and legal advisors to stay put. The case against him, already weak at best, was deteriorating steadily as pretrial motions consistently resolved in his favor and significant bits of evidence were ruled inadmissible. A more rational defendant might have realized that he stood a good chance of acquittal and that beating the murder charge in Colorado would probably have dissuaded other prosecutors. With as little as a year and a half to serve on the Durant conviction, had Ted persevered, he could have been a free man. Instead, Bundy assembled a new plan to escape. He acquired a detailed floor plan of the jail and a hacksaw blade from other inmates and accumulated $500 in cash smuggled in over a six-month period. He later said by visitors, Carol Ann Boone in particular. During the evenings, while other prisoners were showering, he sawed a hole about 1 square foot between the steel reinforcing bars in his cell's ceiling and, having lost 35 pounds, was able to wriggle through it into the crawl space above. In the weeks that followed, he made a series of practice runs exploring the space. Multiple reports from an informant of movement within the ceiling during the night were not investigated.
They're like, those are just rats.
I was going to say, it's like, no, you're just crazy. Like, you're just hearing things. So by late 1977, Bundy's impending trial had become a heated debate in the small town of Aspen, and Bundy filed a motion for a change of venue to Denver. On December 23rd, the Aspen trial judge granted the request, but to Colorado Springs, where juries had historically been hostile to murder suspects. On the night of December 30th, with most of the jail staff on Christmas break and nonviolent prisoners on furlough with their families, which I didn't know was a thing, but that sounds concerning, Bundy piled books and files in his bed, covered them with a blanket to simulate his sleeping body, and climbed into the crawl space. He broke through the ceiling into the apartment of the chief jailer, who was out for the evening with his wife, changed into street clothes from the jailer's closet, and walked out the front door to freedom.
Wait, so none of the security people or anything? Like,
guess not.
Did he evade them, or they just were like, oh, it's just so-and-so that we've seen in a jumpsuit before.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if this was like a big prison and they just like assumed it was just another officer that they just didn't remember what he looked like and just let him go. Like, whatever. I'm not quite sure. But they're like, hey, he's in normal clothes, so he can't be an inmate. All right. Bye-bye. Have a good Christmas break. So after stealing a car, Bundy drove eastward out of Glenwood Springs, but the car soon broke down in the mountains of Interstate 70. A passing motorist gave him a ride into Vail, 60 miles to the east. From there, he caught a bus to Denver, where he boarded a morning flight to Chicago, which, like, what? How? How are you? I mean, I guess this is
the
70s, so it's like, how are you getting on a plane?
Yeah, I'm saying, like,
no, I don't think he did. Yeah. Like, it's just like, I'm like, how are you getting on a, like, a bus? Sure,
things were different in the, when was this, 80s, 70s, or what 70s, was it, the
70s?
Things were different in the 70s.
Yeah, times were different for sure. So in Glenwood Springs, the jail skeleton crew did not discover the escape until noon on December 31st, more than 17 hours later. By then, he was already in Chicago. Yeah. Following a change of venue to Miami, Bundy stood trial for, is it Chi or Chi Omega? Is it Chi Omega? Chi? Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about the Greek alphabet. All right. Chi Omega, homicides and assaults in June 1979. The trial was covered by 250 reporters from five continents and was the first to be televised nationally in the United States. Despite the presence of five court-appointed attorneys, Bundy again handled much of his own defense. From the beginning, he quote, sabotaged the entire defense effort out of spite, distrust, and grandiose delusion. Attorney Polly Nelson, a member of his his last defense team, wrote of Ted. Ted was facing murder charges with a possible death sentence, and all that mattered to him apparently was that he be in charge. So this guy just sounds like a delight to work with. I'm really surprised that if it did actually happen the way that it did, that last guy, his last attorney, lasted so long.
I was like, it just seemed like, because how many attorneys did he go through? At least like two or three, I want.
I think two or three,
something like that. I forget. But yeah, it just seemed like a lot. He didn't want to take their advice. It seemed like he thought he knew everything there was to know.
He's a law student.
Yeah, I was like, he wasn't even an actual lawyer. He was just a student. He didn't even finish his education, even, right?
No.
Yeah, I was like, he didn't finish it, right?
No. According to Mike Minerva, a Tallahassee public defender and member of the defense team, a pretrial plea bargain was negotiated in which Bundy would plead guilty to killing Levy, Bowman, and Leach in exchange for a firm 75-year prison sentence, by one account, because prospects of losing at trial were very good. Bundy, on the other hand, saw the plea deal not only as a means of avoiding the death penalty, but also as a tactical move. He could enter his plea, then wait a few years for evidence to disintegrate or become lost, and for witnesses to die, move on, or retract their testimony. Once the case against him had deteriorated beyond repair, he could file a post-conviction motion to set aside the plea and secure an acquittal. At the last minute, however, Bundy refused the deal. It made him realize he was going to have to stand up in front of the whole world and say he was guilty, Minerva said. He just couldn't do it. Pride just wouldn't let him.
I was like, he was just so on about him being innocent of these crimes. When I'm like, bro, come on.
At trial, crucial testimony came from the Chi Omega sorority members, Connie Hastings, who placed Bundy in the vicinity of the Chi Omega house that evening, and Nita Neary, who saw him leaving the sorority house clutching the Oak murder weapon. Incriminating physical evidence included impressions of the bite wounds Bundy had inflicted on Lisa Levy's left buttock, which forensic odontologists, which are dentists, pretty much, Richard Suvron and Lowell Levine matched to castings of Bundy's teeth. The jury deliberated for less than 7 hours before convicting him on July 24th, 1979 of the Bowman and Levy murders, three counts of attempted first degree murder for the assaults on Kleiner, Chandler, and Thomas, and two counts of burglary. Trial judge Edward Cowart imposed death sentences for the murder convictions. 6 months later, a second trial took place in Orlando for the abduction and murder of Kimberly Leach. Bundy was found guilty once again after less than 8 hours of deliberation, due principally to the testimony of an eyewitness who saw him leading Leach from the schoolyard to his stolen van. Important material evidence included clothing fibers with an unusual manufacturing error, found in the van and on Leach's body, which matched fibers from the jacket Bundy was wearing when he was arrested. During the penalty phase of the trial, Bundy took advantage of an obscure Florida law providing that a marriage declaration in court in the presence of a judge constituted a legal marriage. As he was questioning former Washington State DES co-worker Carol Ann Boone, who had moved to Florida to be near Bundy, had testified on his behalf both during both trials and was again testifying on his behalf as a character witness. He asked her to marry him. She accepted, and Bundy declared to the court that they were legally married.
Louis. I could not imagine being this lady, though.
No,
she, like, talk about like low self-esteem, or she was in a worse place than probably Liz was if she married this guy and then later on got pregnant by him. Like,
yeah. Oh yeah. 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 She was no better than, you know, these other fangirls that were waiting outside the courthouse. And on February 10th, 1980, Bundy was sentenced for a third time to death by electrocution. As the sentence was announced, he reportedly stood and shouted, "Tell the jury they were wrong." This third death sentence would be the only one ultimately carried out nearly 9 years later. And in October 1981, Boone gave birth to a daughter and named Bundy as the father. While conjugal visits were not allowed at Rayford Prison, inmates were known to pool their money in order to bribe guards to allow them intimate time alone with their female visitors.
Gross. Could you imagine being the daughter?
I know. I wonder how she feels.
I did mention some stuff about her in my little bit, right? That I'll talk about.
Okay. I don't like, have anything on it, but yikes.
She needs to be in like witness protection, you know?
I don't know. It's not like any, I mean, I guess for her own embarrassment, maybe.
I was going to say, I was like, it's more of like shame than anything.
Yeah, for sure. I was like immediately thinking people coming after her, but it's like, it's not her fault.
Yeah, no, no.
But you know how people are. They don't care if it's her fault or not. They're still going to blame her. It's like, so.
They should freaking blame Carol Ann or psycho mom, but
she didn't ask to be born. I will briefly say something about her later on in my little bit. But yeah, so I am going to be talking about what happened in the film that did not happen IRL. But I think for the most part, this film was, I mean, pretty accurate compared to, you know, what Liz said in her book, as well as different interviews that the director had with Liz. So, I mean, it's obviously everything that they know is based off of Liz, but what they know based off of her is kind of like pretty accurate. And as they also took into account, you know, the courtroom footage that we kind of saw at the end of the film, which I thought actor was funny when I was watching it. And, you know, I think they had writing and then they also had footage. And I was like, damn, we got a twofer. We got live and words. I was like, okay, different.
It's like, ooh, we're in for a treat this week.
For real, I was like, oh, but I did like it because I kind of, it was just cool seeing that they like definitely reenacted that stuff. But yeah,
specifically that scene where he's coming out of the elevator, that was great. He like pretty much reenacted that like word for word. Mm-hmm. That was pretty good.
Yeah, there was a lot of it that was like word for word. I was pretty impressed. But yeah, so according to the director, Berlinger. Okay. So according to the director, Berlinger, there are three changes to the story that didn't actually happen, and at least one character that was made up. Three major changes. I'm sure there's probably other little details in there that weren't exactly correct or portrayed correctly, but these are like the three main ones that he kind of, I guess, takes note of. First, the timeline of the trials and courtroom scenes were compressed because they obviously couldn't fit everything in the film or it would be a million years long. For example, Berlinger said in Florida, there was actually a second murder trial after he was sentenced to death. He had abducted a girl named Kimberly Leach after the Chi Omega murders, and before he was tried, we decided not to shoot the Kimberly Leach trial because the film couldn't support yet another murder trial. For that reason, Bundy's proposal to Carol Ann Boone was moved to the trial for the murders that happened at the Florida State University sorority Chi Omega. So they kind of just did, you know, put those together, which, I mean, makes sense, as we already said. Second, many of the scenes between Bundy and Boone were based purely on guesswork. We have no idea what Carol Ann Boone and Ted actually said to each other, Berlinger said. So, of course, that stuff is invented, the interpersonal dialogue. So I was like curious. I had to look it up because, you know, like what the hell happened to these ladies after the events. So, yeah, so they had a child together. Her name was Rose. And basically no one really knows like where she's at. There's kind of just rumors and speculation as where she's at. people think that she, of course, changed her name and might have actually moved away from the US because, you know, like her dad is Ted Bundy. And I think she's just obviously shamed and just doesn't want to deal with it. Because I mean, I would obviously change my name too if my dad was an infamous murderer. So basically, that's just kind of like speculation. No one really knows. No one, you know, there's no really records of her or anything, but people just assume that she changed her name and moved away. When I was writing this, I was like, yeah, I would probably do the same thing if my dad was Ted Bundy, my mom was crazy enough to marry him and have a child and think he was innocent of the, like, you know, murderers. And so I'm like, yeah, I mean, I would be ashamed of both of them, like my mom and my dad. Like,
yeah,
like your mom was like willfully ignorant, I feel like, in this situation, and was just like, again, blinded by some weird like love and obsession kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That lady has issues, basically. I did not actually look into her mother, but I think her mom's dead. I'm not sure. Let me look that up real fast because I was more interested in the daughter.
I just hope she had a good childhood. Like, I wonder if Carol was like a good mom.
I don't know. She married a freaking murderer, dude.
Yeah. Right. And then, I mean, did you guys see how Ted called her the morning that he was supposed to be executed and she refused his call? It was kind of like,
of Carol.
Carol refused Ted's call the morning he was executed.
And that was kind of surprising.
Like, well, because at that time she was like really upset because he actually started a new relationship with somebody else. And so she was like upset he has a new girlfriend. And and she was upset because he was confessing to all these murders. And she's like, this whole time I stood by your side saying you're innocent and now you're confessing to everything. So she felt betrayed by that. But I'm like, dude, it's like the morning he's going to die. Like, at least maybe let him talk to his daughter. I know, like, maybe, I don't know. Maybe that's not the best idea. It's just like I felt for him in that moment because it's like, this is the morning you're going to die. Like,
I don't feel for him, okay? He's a freaking murderer of like 30 plus people, okay?
I don't know. That was,
I guess I felt it in more for the daughter, I guess. It's like, you know, she would want to talk to her dad before.
Yeah, in that regard, died. Yeah, because like obviously she's already fucking traumatized as a human being for being born in this type of relationship. Yeah,
I just felt like Carol was being a little too selfish in that moment. Like, she was only thinking about how she felt betrayed by Teddy. Well, Teddy, why did I call him that?
I'm real affectionate for him.
Did you guys ever watch Prison Break?
Yeah.
Isn't there a character named Teddy or Ted or something?
Oh, I don't remember that much about it.
I think I was like thinking about it. I was thinking about him for a second, but
yeah, the one time that I actually did feel bad for him and I had to like second guess why the heck am I feeling bad for him was when that that Florida, I think he was like a prosecutor, attorney, whatever, came in and tore up Molly's drawing for him, the shark.
Mm-hmm. What the hell? I don't remember that. I must have been looking at my phone or something during that part.
Yeah, no, they came in shit. Yeah, he, like, forcefully took the impressions of his teeth and stuff, and he's like, this year in Florida now where we take murder real seriously. And so like the one time I felt bad was when he came in and like tore up that picture. I was just like, why am I feeling bad for this guy?
But I mean, you're probably feeling bad because that's like his only humanity that he freaking has is probably that connection. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm just reading this, so I'm looking up, you know, Carol Ann Boone, and I was just reading a part because I guess you know, they were, I guess, I'm not allowed to have sex there, but they said intercourse was possible behind a water cooler in the restroom or sometimes at the table. Just thought it was funny because I'm like, I guess that was kind of portrayed correctly though in the film where they were doing it behind the freaking vending machine thing. The last major change was the scene at the end when Liz visits Ted in prison and he confesses his crimes to her. He didn't happen in that way. He didn't, or she didn't go there and face to face with him and he confessed things, or, you know, like how she was like, free me, free me. Also, I was kind of annoyed, and that's just because she kept saying like, free me of this, and he was like, I didn't do it or whatever, and then she just kept repeating it and until he finally confessed. I don't know why, but that just irritated me that she just kept having to say that.
It was weird. It was a little cringy.
I kind of liked it. I don't know. I thought it was a pretty good scene because I felt like what she was trying to get across to him was like, if you actually do love me and care for me that much, you won't put this burden on me and like let me go of it so I can live.
Yeah.
So I can live my life type
of thing. I think it annoyed me because to me, it seemed like he was the type of person to also say what people wanted to hear. And so when she kept doing that, I'm like, dude, how do you even know he's telling you the truth? It seems to me like he could just be telling you something that you might want to hear in order for you to, I don't know
but though, because I feel like that was the one thing he was never gonna do, even, you know, it was admit his guilt until the very end.
That's true.
And at the very end, he only did it in hopes that it would like
elongate his
to
where he got killed or whatever. I guess so. I mean, so it didn't happen in that way. He did do a confession to Liz, but it happened over the phone and not face to face when he was on death row. In Liz's memoir, she noted that Bundy called her in 1978 about the details that were going to come out about his then suspected killings. "It's going to be bad, real bad, when it breaks tomorrow. I want you to be prepared. It could be really ugly. I wish we could sit down alone and talk about things," Bundy told her, "with nobody listening, about why I am the way I am." So he wasn't really like taking, I feel like to me that is, he wasn't taking accountability. He's like blaming it on, I don't know, like childhood trauma, which is, I mean, obviously you should take into account, but it's like you killed 30 plus people. So like, whatever. But yeah, Bundy didn't immediately give Liz any details, but returned with another phone call a week later, revealing that he felt the urges to kill and remembered everything he had done. "I don't have a split personality. I don't have blackouts. I remember everything I've done," the memoir read. "The force would just consume me. Like one night I was walking by the campus and I followed the sorority girl. I didn't want to follow her. I tried not to, but I'd do it anyway. I have a sickness," he continued, "a disease like your alcoholism. You can't take another drink, and with my sickness, there is something that I just can't be around, and I know it now." So that was the way he confessed to her. And then, so lastly, it's not really a scene, but it's just the character. So Haley Joel Osment's character, Jerry, he was just a made up character for the film because they wanted to, I guess, have a person to, well, to me, when I was watching it, because once I found out he wasn't real, it seemed like it was more of someone, like he was like the person that was like kind of like her internal like fight, like struggle, be like her telling her to, like, you know, get away from him, like basically her trying to convince herself like he's no good, kind of a thing. So I feel like that's kind of what Jerry's character did for her. But I guess she did confide in a man named Hank, who she met during an AA meeting, but there's not like, that's not where they got the idea for Jerry. They just mentioned that in this article that I read, but I thought it was kind of funny because I'm like, damn, it's AA, you're supposed to be anonymous, and it's in this article, his freaking name. I was like, that's messed up. But anyways,
was her friend real?
Yes, her friend was real. Okay. They were friends for a long time, I want to say. And that's what I'm saying. I think she was the one that was trying to convince her to call it in about him. And I think she was the one who kind of saw more of the red flags than Liz did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For sure. Don't it always happen that way?
Yeah, that is true.
Mm-hmm. I guess I just wanted to bring up, because I remember like watching a video or something somewhere, but I just like remembered it when Alec was talking about like the hair in the crime scene.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because I think last year I got into watching Forensic Files and
Files.
Yeah.
That's my go-to like 12 a.m. in a hotel room show. It's
really?
Gone. For some reason.
I think
reason.
They have it on Netflix too.
Oh,
I think now they do.
Well, anyways, the thing is that they kind of talk about how some, you know, people, when they look at the hair strands, they're just looking to see if it would like look like the other one. There's no way to like test the DNA until like sometime in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And then something like got brought up about like the teeth impressions and how like actually nowadays, if they were to take those teeth impressions of Ted Bundy and then try to match it up, like that wasn't proving anything either.
Oh, so really?
Yeah. And that was like a huge thing as well, as showing how his teeth matched up with the bite mark.
Yeah.
His teeth were pretty dang specific, man. They were
jacked. I know. I know. He did not have like perfect teeth or anything. So I get that. But I thought that was crazy how like that evidence would be like tossed out now.
Yeah, nowadays. I mean, there are a lot of, I mean, even back in the day, they didn't really, what is it, like close off murder scenes or whatever. Murders happened, they didn't do like a good job at closing those off, so like people would be walking through there, so like basically evidence would be tampered with, and so that's when, because you know they didn't know things that they know now,
right?
And so, but now they know to like Clinton, don't let anyone in here until we like, you know, get our shit in order, basically. So I know that's different.
Yeah, so that was the only thing I just remember, like, it was the whole teeth thing, because that was a huge thing that got him, and he was also so, like, against getting his teeth, them getting an impression of his teeth, so
that
also kind of.
Because he knew.
Yeah, exactly.
He knew it'd do him in.
Yeah, but I was just thinking that the whole time. I was like, what if, you know, if, like, this happened today and they didn't have that evidence and they didn't have the hair, what would they have?
I know.
And what if he could actually get away with it? But I'm sure they had a lot more evidence and a lot more.
The thing is, I think now they would have been able to find more evidence because they didn't know, I feel like, what to look for back in the day.
Right. So they probably could have found semen somewhere, maybe like the saliva on her butt cheek, right?
Because I don't even think fingerprinting or anything like that was a big deal.
Because they did find semen on the bed in the sorority or whatever. But, like, I don't know what they did with it. They don't test
maybe
it.
They didn't, maybe they couldn't test it. They just knew someone was there, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so I remember what I was going to talk about. But we did actually already talk about it. I was just going to talk about how many victims and, like, about the teenage thing. But we did already talk about it already.
Yeah, yeah. That
I just remembered right now.
He probably – that is crazy, too, that he probably started his crimes – at a young age.
Yeah. Like, well, I guess he, because they said that he admitted to like 35 or 30 plus murders, but they think it's actually like well above that because they think he started when he was actually a lot younger and that he just didn't admit to a whole bunch that he did do or whatever. So they think it's a lot more than that. But I think that's also what I saw about Ted, is that he was saying something about like when he was younger, it was more just like random or whatever when he would kill. But then as he like started getting better at it, he was like saying like, it's like basically he cleaned his act up a little bit with it. And he was smarter and stuff like that.
So it was like more calculated.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, they all had like similar, because didn't most of them like have long brown hair and stuff? Like
that was also like the Son of Sam or something like that. That was, they had the, like Ted Bundy. And then his name is, I forgot his real name, but it's like the Son of Sam.
Yeah.
They both had like their victims were women and they had like certain hairdos and stuff like that. And at the time, I think women were all changing their hair.
Because I think they say I remember now. That they attribute that to Liz, right? Is that
they all look similar? No. It was the girlfriend before Liz.
Before Liz? Oh, okay. Because I remember Liz saying that like she wanted to cut her hair or something like that and he like wouldn't let her.
Well, I'm sure like he liked a specific look, but I from what I understand is that the girlfriend he had before Liz is the one that kind of sparked that rage trend against women.
That's another thing I remembered finally. I wanted to say was that I think Liz asked him, I can't remember who asked these questions to him, but I think Liz asked him like, what was there ever a time where you wanted to like kill me or whatever, and he basically and said yes. And that, I guess, and she then after that, she recalls a time where I guess he like basically, I forget how it was, something about I was like, what was it? Because I don't remember the details.
So the details are, I guess he clogged up like the chimney or something so that the smoke couldn't escape the house, and even put a towel like at the door crack. And so he kind of was trying to kill her by smoke inhalation.
Yeah. And so she like woke up coughing or something like that.
And then
like
she opened that. Yeah, she opened the window. She said, I vividly remember like opening up, waking up, and I couldn't breathe. I opened the window, aired everything out. And the next day she gave him grief for not bringing over a fan. But I think they were also saying that they think that he didn't kill her because he had everyone knew that was his girlfriend. So if he did, like it would immediately point fingers to him. There's like so much kind of things with like, why didn't he kill her? Why didn't he spare her? Is it because of love, or is it just because it was too easy to blame him?
Yeah, that would be a pretty big.
He was never in a relationship though with any of the people that he killed previously, right? Like,
no,
if he would have killed her, that would have been the first one he was like actually in a relationship with.
Well, sure, but I feel like, I don't know. It would be
something is not possible.
I just feel like it'd probably be too big of a giveaway.
Yeah.
And then they'd probably be looking to him for all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And he probably felt like having this girlfriend was a cover up, really.
Yeah.
Well, she also made the assumption too that maybe she was his like, I guess, like touch with reality, so that whenever he was like, because she talked about how he would call her all the time. You know, so maybe when he was just like too much, like he was too
high from a kill or something, he would call her to kind of like chill himself out. Or even maybe if he was feeling that impulse to kill, he would like call her to try to like chill himself out, stuff like that. So that was like
she was his like sponsor, like how he was trying to say AA meetings or whatever. Like, you know, when people in AA, they want a drink, they like call their sponsor to like talk them off the ledge. So she was basically that for him, but like she didn't know it.
Yeah, exactly. She did say that like her and her daughter, they spoke about what to do with like the pictures they have of him and like the letters he wrote to her. And they said they just like left it there because I guess they kind of just wanted to remember the good memories, I guess, you know, and not focus too much on the negative. I guess, yeah, everyone has to cope in a different way. I was actually curious about his parents. I actually forgot to look that up because when he was like mom, I was like, which mom? Because did you guys read into his like early life?
Mm-mm.
Because his mom had him out of wedlock, and so the grandparents adopted him, and he thought that his mom was his sister for like most of his life. So I was like, which, that's why I was like, which mom? Like his grandmother, who
probably his grandma,
I don't know. I didn't like, I mean, if you,
I'm just assuming. Well, I would think his grandmother.
Well, the grandmother didn't raise him like all the way through. Eventually his mom, real mom, like I guess she eventually like, took him, and they moved to wherever, like, yeah, they moved away. Ted, the thing about Ted Bundy I think is intriguing for me versus like the crime is just like what instigated this, like what motivated him, like because I think a lot of times they always want to blame like childhood and stuff like that. But there's just like no evidence about him being like, they say the grandfather was abusive, and then they say like, but there's no, it's very like the stories change about the grandfather being abusive. So it's like, we don't know. And then
I don't even know. That's like the whole nature versus nurture type of thing.
Dude, and I listened to this podcast and they were saying that like that's not, it's always more nature versus nurture. Like really? It's actually genetic. Like if you have a
fear, I heard it's like a combo of both. Like
no, I've heard it's mostly nature.
Really?
Like let's say you have a fear. Okay, well let's say you have a fear of spiders. That's actually genetic because probably your mother or father also has a fear of spiders, and then you got that.
But that's that, nurturing. They're nurturing that because they're showing their fear. So then
no, it's genetic. And then there's other things about what? Like this is what I learned in the podcast. I'm not like a scientist here, but this is what they were saying. They were saying like, you know, if there's like sometimes the fears that you have are actually the fears that your parents had, and then it like passed down to you. And so sometimes like, yeah,
I thought nature was like something that you were like born with. You're not born with the fear of spiders.
Yeah. Right? That's what they're saying.
And that you are born with the fear of spiders?
Yeah, but then it kind of makes sense because like, you know, when you think about like evolution and stuff like that, you have a fear of spiders because at one point your ancestor was probably killed by a spider. And so you developed this fear of spiders. And now these days we're like, oh, let's not, I shouldn't go touch a spider and play that's with it, saying. You know? So that's why it's more nature versus nurture. I see
what you're saying.
But that's like
from my quick research just now, I'm pretty sure that the woman that was at the trial, that was his real mom.
Mother.
Oh. Yeah, real mom, who like said that stuff about God and stuff.
Yeah,
the primitive. I just remember she was like a primitive act. I was like, oh, okay. I thought it was kind of a weird word to use. Whatever. Yeah. Okay. We're going on a different topic here.
I was gonna say, sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting conversation, though. Honestly. Thanks for joining us this week on The Internet Historians. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and give us a rating. We would also love to connect with you, so give us a follow on Instagram and subscribe to us on YouTube. Next week, we'll be discussing Alice Paul from the movie Iron-Jawed Angel, so don't forget to tune in. Thanks again, and we will see you next week.
Bye!